It's Thursday, May 13th, and this year's back-to-school supplies include COVID shots. We start here. The CDC gives an A-plus to Pfizer for middle and high schoolers.
If parents have to show up and stand next to the child while they get the vaccine, I think you're going to see certain groups delay it or not get it done.
But 12-year-olds can't just fire up the car and head down to the clinic. So how's this going to work? We've got answers. President Biden's meeting with all top Republicans in Congress, except one.
Basically, they want someone who is like Cheney, but just not speaking out like her.
It's a new chapter for the GOP, so what story will be written?
When the country was established, we were here.
And it's not just the rocket strikes that are making this ugly.
They're rioting. They're basically throwing stones and Molotov cocktails, setting cars on fire.
Israel is getting ready for battles in the streets, but some Palestinians say they've already begun. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. As of this morning, there is a new age range in this country for COVID-19 vaccines.
I am 12 years old, and I'm getting vaccinated.
Late today, the head of the CDC giving the final green light now for the Pfizer vaccine for children 12 to 15 years old.
Yesterday, the CDC joined the FDA in recommending that from now on, anyone 12 or older is eligible for a shot and frankly should be getting one.
How was it?
It was a lot better than I thought it would be. I thought it would hurt, but it was not. It didn't hurt at all.
This life, like we've been living, like with no school and just having to be in your bed all day doing school, I can't do it anymore.
In several states, those expansions begin today. Let's go to ABC's Ann Flaherty, who's been covering this vaccination rollout. Ann, the CDC heard from, you know, one of those scientific advisory panels we've seen before, right? What do scientists have to say about giving this vaccine to, you know, adolescents?
Well, I think we heard really two things yesterday. It was excitement and certainty about this.
The desirable consequences clearly outweigh the undesirable consequences.
I mean, this seemed to be a foregone conclusion from the beginning of the meeting. They spent most of their time talking about whether or not they think kids can get the COVID vaccine at the same time that they can get other vaccines. And the answer to that was yes. To be sure, this is all just related to the Pfizer vaccine. That is the only one that has completed its trials on this 12 to 15 age group.
I have the same vote count, 14 yeses,
oh, sorry. Thank
zero
you.
Noes, and the motion passes. So we can go to comment.
But, you know, at the end of the vote, we even heard one member express personal excitement that she could vaccinate her own kids.
Just as an example, my husband and I are vaccinated. My 16-year-old is vaccinated, and now my 12 to 15-year-old will be in line, and I'm ever so thankful. So thank you.
And the chairman, Jose Romero, said, you know, we're a step closer to ending the pandemic. I think it was just excitement.
So then what happens now? Like, are there specific challenges to getting kids vaccinated? And how will states deal with those challenges?
As I promised last week, we're ready.
So, I mean, the Biden administration wants to address this. They are working with pharmacies, vaccine clinics, community health centers, wherever you can get a vaccine now. They want to make it just as easy for kids in this age group to walk up and get their shot.
Additionally, if teens are on the move this summer, they can get their first shot in one place and a second shot elsewhere.
So the biggest challenge, though, I think we're going to see, Brad, really is access, because, you know, kids in some states might have to have their parents with them, for example. They're going to have consent forms that they're going to have to fill out. If parents have to show up and stand next to the child while they get the vaccine, I think you're going to see certain groups just delay it or not get it done. So where I think
like if you have an 8-year-old, like, yeah, you're used to standing next to them all the time. Like a 14-year-old, yeah, they do some stuff without their parents.
Yeah, it's tricky though, but they're not driving either. You know, I think one of the things that they want to see is that they get these shots rolled into the other vaccines that are required when you're headed into seventh grade. A lot of schools require those. I think where we're headed probably are school clinics, where principals are going to start to push. You know, you bring in that parental consent form the same way you would a field trip, and you say, yeah, you know, I'm ready to roll up my sleeve. I mean, there's going to be a real push, I think, in the back to school days. Leading up to fall, to get all of these kids vaccinated, because it's very important to getting schools open and staying open.
Which means, I guess, that the parents have to trust not just like the healthcare system, like the vaccine itself that we've been told is completely safe in the same way it is for adults, but they would have to trust like the school, like the administration that they're sending their kid off to. Here's a question for you. I mean, the CDC gave its recommendation.
does everyone care what the CDC thinks at this point? Like, some states gave their own green lights before this hearing even began yesterday. Like, I think Susan Collins from Maine even said she no longer thinks of the CDC as the gold standard for recommendations. Like, that seems worrisome.
That was a tough challenge to the CDC.
So here we have unnecessary barriers to reopening schools, exaggerating the risks of outdoor transmission.
And you could see it on the director's face during that, her testimony. She was very adamant that the CDC is moving as carefully and as fast as it can in line with the science. I mean, you know, scientists are not going to urge people to go without their masks until they know for sure that vaccinated people don't transmit this virus. Most people think that's the case, but we don't have data to back that up yet that is definitive.
Bill and Liz, the Yankees and Rays will play tonight in St. Petersburg. That much we know. What is still unclear is how many of the Yankee coaches are directly affected by tonight's news that third base coach Phil Nevin is in quarantine with the virus. Adding another wrinkle to this is the fact that Nevin has been fully vaccinated.
You know, you think about hearing about the Yankees, these breakthrough cases in some sports players.
Six of the seven are asymptomatic.
That's really a mystery to a lot of people, but it's also an example of why the CDC moves so slow. I mean, there's a lot we don't know about this virus. So, you know, having the case numbers down before you peel back those mask mandates, hopefully that will happen before fall.
We want to wait till the last minute.
Side effects other than the ones they've shown come up, you never know.
You know, I want to add, I'm a parent. I have a 12-year-old at home, and I was really interested in the safety data on this. You know, it is a little bit different. It's a different equation when you're going and you're trying to figure out if your own child is going to get vaccinated.
For them personally, you know, it's a great, great thing, but it's bigger than just them.
At the end of the day, though, I think there is a really strong case that the only way that we get back to normal and keeping our kids out of quarantine is by vaccinating them.
Yeah, and that point you brought up earlier, I think, is a perfect example of, you know, we're still learning all that we can do with these vaccines. Originally, it was don't take any other vaccines within 2 weeks of this one. We don't know enough about how they interact. Now, it's you can get your kid the flu shot. You can get them their COVID vaccine. We have the data now to show that it's safe, and hopefully that will alleviate some of these forthcoming logistical issues specific to kids. Ann Flaherty, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, President Biden is asking Republicans what they want. Some Republicans are asking that of themselves as well. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you have any comments on the efforts to oust Liz Cheney from the House Republican leadership vote? I don't understand your problem.
President Joe Biden has spent the week saying, I don't particularly care how the GOP organizes itself. I don't care if the Republicans kick Liz Cheney, who was once considered the party's next Speaker of the House, out of her leadership spot. All I want, Biden has insisted, is to work with Republicans to advance his goals, which is easy to say, except the direction of each party directly affects how successful any sort of bipartisan deal-making is going to be. And later today, on the heels of a momentous vote, Republican lawmakers will head over to the White House to tell the president what they will and won't consider. ABC's congressional correspondent Rachel Scott spent the day on the Hill. She joins us now. And Rachel, can we start with that leadership vote yesterday? Like, by the time it began, it was really just a formality, right? Like, it was over in minutes, but how did this play out?
Yeah, the writing was really on the wall here. It was all but certain that Congresswoman Liz Cheney was going to be kicked out of her leadership position, but they huddled behind closed doors.
Can you take us inside of the room today?
I showed up what I thought was on time, a couple minutes late, but
within a couple minutes. It was just taking a voice vote.
And Congresswoman Liz Cheney came forward and sort of begged her colleagues to not let former President Donald Trump drag them, quote, backwards and make them complicit in his efforts to sort of unravel democracy. But then you know what happened? They booed her. And then within 15 minutes, she was ousted in the secret voice vote.
They've started the narrative that this was going to be overwhelming. There's no way to prove it wouldn't have been overwhelming. And quite honestly, Liz might have survived that vote. But I think she's okay with the idea of not having to every month go under this attempt to overthrow her. And she's liberated to tell the truth. And frankly,
I am absolutely committed, as I said last night, as I said just now to my colleagues, that we must go forward based on truth. We cannot both embrace the big lie and embrace the Constitution.
And so now you have Cheney, who is defiant. She is saying that she's going to continue speaking out. This is definitely not the last that we've heard from her.
I will do everything I can to ensure that the former president never again gets anywhere near the Oval Office.
But there's still a question here of who exactly is going to replace Cheney as conference chair.
And you still think 140,000 votes are illegitimate?
I think there are questions that are important for American people to hear answers.
Trump has endorsed Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, and so has the Republican leadership, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise. That vote is going to happen on Friday. But there are some concerns that she's not conservative enough. I've been talking to some Republican sources who have actually expressed concern over her record. Look, you have Cheney. She voted with Trump more than 90% of the time. But what they don't like is just how outspoken she is consistently about Trump.
Let me posit to you this. If you had a member of the Democrat leadership who said they didn't believe in climate change anymore, do you think they would still remain in Democrat leadership? I don't think so.
And so basically they want someone who is like Cheney, but just not speaking out like her. And that's where Congressman Chip Roy comes in. He sent out this memo to all the House Republicans questioning just how conservative Elise Stefanik is.
Competition's good.
You think it's healthy for the conference?
Oh, yeah, competition's good. I've had people always run against me as well, and competition's good. That's why I didn't have the election today.
And so they're saying now maybe hold off, and Roy is possibly considering himself jumping in to challenge Stefanik.
Well, and so that'll happen on Friday. In the meantime, I guess at least each party knows who's in its leadership, or like who knows who's not in its leadership, right? So does that clear the way for stuff to actually happen? Like when it comes to infrastructure, economic stimulus, or anything, when Joe Biden talks to some of these Republicans?
Well, we had a good hour and a half meeting with the president, the vice president.
Well, you have Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has made it clear that his mission here is to work against the Biden agenda.
Clearly, Senate Republicans are not interested in revisiting the 2017 tax bill. I think the president and the vice president understand that. Beyond that, we're interested in trying to get an outcome.
You know, infrastructure is one area when you talk to Republicans where they really do believe there could be some bipartisan compromise. But we talk so much about the divide within the Republican Party. President Joe Biden has a significant challenge with getting his own party on the same page.
If I could just quickly ask you about infrastructure. I know you met with President Joe Biden.
Uh-huh. I spoke to Senator Joe Manchin on Capitol Hill, and he does not support this massive package that Biden is pushing.
We're looking at something constructively that really fixes the needs, not only the bridges and the roads that we have, but the infrastructure, traditional infrastructure. As you recall, it's President Biden's bill was an all-encompassing bill that had human infrastructure. Right. I think that we're ready to separate those and basically deal with one at a time.
He says he believes this needs to be broken up into two, and they need to push forward with a more narrow package that is less expensive.
You guys are bad. I'm not supposed to be answering all these questions. I'm supposed to leave, but I can't resist your questions. I came away encouraged.
So later today, you're going to see Republicans back at the White House for another day trying to hash out the details of this infrastructure package.
What I don't want to do, and this will be another discussion we didn't get into today, is how to pay for it.
But look, their top line is between $600 billion and $800 billion. That is far less than what President Joe Biden is pushing.
And if everything is paid for by a user fee, well then, you know, the burden falls on working class folks who are who are having trouble.
They do not want tax hikes. And so that's going to be a very key disagreement between the president and Republicans. Biden, if he wants bipartisan support, if he wants Republicans, he's going to have to come down on this quite a bit. And he sort of has set a deadline by Memorial Day. He wanted to see progress in these bipartisan negotiations. And it's just unclear if he's really getting there.
All right. Rachel Scott in Washington. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thanks, Brad.
When air raid sirens go off, you run and hide. But if you looked up at the sky in Tel Aviv this week, you would see dozens of little fireballs heading towards you. Those are rockets launched from the Gaza Strip about 50 miles away. Then you would see these other little fireballs head up towards them and explode them in midair. This is the Iron Dome, the Israeli missile defense system at work. And if you watch these glimmers of light dancing, it would be mesmerizing to watch until you remembered that these are bombs and that some are getting through and killing people. 50 miles away in the Palestinian territories, you might also look up and see a drone hovering over a building. Again, really loud warnings, people run away. But if you stopped and looked up, you'd see this drone fire a small shot into a building, almost a test shot to really convince people inside, you gotta go now. Then the real attack comes from the drone. The building is decimated, and these neighborhoods have no missile defense systems. This back and forth has been happening and growing for 3 days now, and the question now is, are we approaching a full-scale war around Israel? ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman is back with us in Tel Aviv. Are we getting past a point of no return, or is this lightening up a little bit?
This does not seem to be very close to ending at all at this point, although a lot fewer rockets launched from Gaza. We have no idea if it's because those dozens and dozens of Israeli warplane sorties flattening those buildings. It looked like a demolition team. Sappers had gone in there and just used dynamite on all the foundations and just leveled it the way they crumbled. And they call that a door knock, what you just talked about, that drone sort of letting people know that there is going to be a massive bombardment. You guys better get out of here. The reason they do that is because they don't want to kill the people who live in that building, but what they do want to do is demolish the building because in some place inside there is allegedly Hamas or Islamic Jihad infrastructure. So they want to take out either their intelligence capacities, communication capacities, or rockets if, let's say, they're buried somewhere in the basement. So that's what we've been seeing. And, you know, we have to note, it is by far the civilians of both sides who are bearing the brunt of this.
My children yesterday were sitting with their teeth knocking because they are so afraid. Do you understand?
In Israel, over 4 million people, more, have been living under the threat of these rocket attacks. These alarms and sirens have been sounding.
I don't ignore the children in Gaza, but the people there need not be subjected anymore to a terrorist organization.
We've seen well over 50 Palestinians, over a dozen kids killed in these attacks. Seven Israelis, including a six-year-old boy, killed by one of the rocket attacks. 150 people wounded.
More than 1,000 rockets fired from Gaza, one landing on a residential street outside Tel Aviv, setting a car on fire.
And with each death and with each wounding and each what seems like escalation, it looks like, okay, there's got to be another reprisal to that so we can add another day to this.
But the situation is definitely very tense. We understand that the terrorists in Gaza are committed to trying to terrorize Israeli civilians and try to kill Israeli civilians.
And just one more addendum to that. I just spoke to the Israeli military. They said, hey, we're taking this on an hourly basis. We are not in any way ruling out an invasion of Gaza. We're calling up brigades, but we're not there yet. Hmm. What we want to do is just limit to the best ability, the capacity for Hamas to launch rockets into Israel.
Well, you kind of touched on this yesterday, but I think it's become even more apparent in the last 24 hours or so that the long distance stuff, the rockets, the missiles, that's not even as unusual to see as what people have been seeing up close. What we've been seeing on a more local level in places like Jerusalem, these on the ground, nasty conflicts between neighbors. Does that almost say more about where this conflict is right now?
It's Jerusalem. It's cities you've never heard of in Israel, from Tiberias to Akko to Lod. These are mixed towns with Jewish and Arab populations, both of them citizens of Israel.
We're in Lod, where there have been riots for several consecutive nights. You can see the burnt out cars here.
But the Arabs feel like they're second class citizens.
When the country was established, we were here. So we are locals. Keep discriminating us all the time.
You see it in the schools. They get less funding for schools. They get less funding for infrastructure in the areas where they live, and they say they are fed up.
More than 100 worshippers and protesters were injured as Israeli police stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque using tear gas and rubber bullets.
There have been hundreds of Israeli Palestinians wounded, people with Israeli citizenship wounded. I think the latest number is well over 360. They're rioting. They're basically throwing stones and Molotov cocktails, setting cars on fire.
Standing here today in a synagogue that was burned overnight by Israeli Arab civilians. We will not allow anyone to violate our sovereignty on the state of Israel.
And what we're hearing now is that Israel is essentially declaring martial law in these towns, declaring a state of emergency and bringing in the military. So there is conflict on multiple fronts, Israel versus the Palestinians, the Palestinian Israelis against the Israelis. And we saw something that I have never seen covering this story for 20 years. Nothing like it. Just south of Tel Aviv, an angry Jewish Israeli mob attacked, pulled out of a car. An Arab they found, they didn't know this guy, and they beat him to within an inch of his life. He's critically wounded, finally taken to the hospital, left on the street, gushing blood. This is stuff we haven't seen. There is conflict here on so many fronts. It's very hard to understand what's going on. The only thing I can tell you right now is it does not seem close to being over.
Right, and you know what you're talking about. You actually lived in Jerusalem for a long time covering the Middle East. Matt Gutman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, we're going to step away once more real quick. When we come back, we're cooking with gas, if we can find some. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing, how's this for pedal to the metal?
Long lines, gas stations out of fuel, and that report of $7 a gallon in one location.
I pulled in, I started pumping my gas, and then I realized I'm putting $80 worth in my truck.
Ever since the cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline forced the company to shut down one of the biggest gas suppliers on the East Coast, the problem has seemed to intensify every few hours.
So this whole line is just to get into one gas station.
And you can see right here, someone has brought several gas cans to stock up on whatever gas is left.
Yesterday morning, as people continued to panic buy gas, the tracking firm GasBuddy estimated that 15% of gas stations in South Carolina and Virginia had run out of fuel. That sounds bad, 15%. Well, by the afternoon, that had skyrocketed to 50%.
It just hurt me because I done went to 5 or 6 gas stations and nobody just seems to have gas. It's crazy out here, like...
In North Carolina, 2 out of 3 gas stations had run dry. Again, yes, this is an important pipeline, but as officials were watching folks filling up extra reserve tanks, they were like, this is what's causing the shortage.
This is not a supply or a production issue. It's a transportation issue. There is plenty of gas in this country, and I want to make sure people know we are not running out of gas.
Well, last night, Colonial Pipeline announced it has turned its systems
back on. Now, whether this was because they've completely recovered from that hack or they're just trying to buy some time, they say it'll take a couple days for the pipeline to be back at 100%, which was expected. In the meantime, cities have had to scramble for solutions.
They waiver from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for the use of the winter fuel that was held in storage.
Charlotte, North Carolina, made its public transit completely free. Some gas stations have trucked in whatever fuel they can get their hands on, like premium or diesel, but then they had to start begging drivers to stop trying to put diesel in their unleaded tanks. The worst part about panic buying gas is if you're driving all over town waiting in lines, you're actually burning through the gas that has become so valuable to you.
Thankfully, I live right down the road. I got just enough to make it home.
Now, governors that declared preemptive states of emergency just in case there were shortages are being asked, you still think declaring an emergency was a good idea, or did you accidentally create one yourself? You'd think if there was any time we could all just get through this together, it would have been the pandemic when people are still not commuting to work in the same numbers, right? But I guess the pandemic also got us used to getting stuff quickly. Like, don't ask Amazon to send you a box of gas today, at least. Please, I beg you. Start here tomorrow. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.